You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. After 34 years through five presidential administrations dating back to Ronald Reagan, more than 5,000 Major League games, 23 postseason assignments, including five World Series, and serving as crew chief for what was truly a fall classic last October, our guest has retired as a Major League umpire. What a resume. What a baseball life. We welcome Ted Randall's Talking Baseball, presumably stretched out in his hammock, John Hirschbeck. You stretched out in your hammock, right?
No, I'm not. I took 5 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever you need to sit and talk to you. But I'm busy all the time, having fun, you know.
Go back to the very beginning. The first time you ever umpired a Little League game, you were a high school kid doing games as a part-time job in your native Connecticut, right?
Right. I was a senior in high school, and for anybody listening, I was not a good baseball player. The last time I played, I was 12 years old and in Little League, and that was it. But being a senior, I needed money to go to my prom. The guy in town said, hey, if you want to umpire Little League, we'll pay you $5 a game. So I did it that year and really enjoyed it. Really, really enjoyed it. And went away to Central Connecticut State University next year and took a test and did it high school ball and under, and just loving it more and more and watching TV and wondering how they ever get to do it at that level. And I found out about umpiring school, and there I am 41 years later.
Did you get enough money for the prom, and how'd the prom go?
The prom went okay. She was probably lucky to get rid of me, but no, I've never seen her again.
You umpired at Central Connecticut State, and your brother also got involved. And ultimately, he too, Mark, made it to the major leagues.
He did. When I was in AAA, he was in high school, and he would came on the road with me once in a while, and he goes, John, I really like this. And I said, well, forget the lifestyle. I said, you better go home and umpire and see if you like that part of it. So he did, and loved it also. And he was young, because he only went, I think, 1 year to college, and I think he was 19 or 18 when he went to umpiring school. And ended up working 15 years in the big leagues before a hip replacement that didn't work out right got his career.
You go to umpire school, as you said, and then graduate second in your class, and you go to the Florida State League in 1976. That's your first assignment. What do you remember about that first year? Beside the fact it was hot.
Nervous? No, I don't even remember the heat. Just being nervous, you know, like a kid. You know, the thing about A-ball is it's the perfect concoction for arguments and trouble, because you have kids who are out of high school and college, and they're just starting out. And then you have managers and coaches who have either been in the big leagues or on their way down and learning how to manage. And then you have kids coming out of umpiring school, young people, and really don't know what we're doing, you know, and trying to learn the game. And everyone's trying to learn the professional game of baseball. And I just remember having argument after argument and, you know, run-ins with players and managers, and it was ugly. It was ugly my first year, believe me.
But I really often thought
about saying, like, okay, that's enough. I'm going home.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, but not enough to discourage you and get out of the business.
No, because deep down I knew that that's what I wanted. I just had such a passion for it, and I just knew that that's what I wanted. So, you know, you make it to September 1st when the minor league season is over, and you go home, get a little rest, and then actually, whether I was working for UPS or hanging drywall for my winter jobs, then you realize, like, okay, that's really not that bad to work a few hours a day, and I still love it, still want to be doing it. So, you know, then you leave for it with an attitude like, okay, I can't wait to get started again.
But you do think that, wow, this can't be like this all the time, being an umpire. Right.
I prayed to God that it wasn't going to be. It took even my second year was a lot of that kind of thing. And then I went, believe it or not, I have to say this on the air here. My first year, I threw out 28 players and managers.
Wow.
And that's in a short season. That's without September. And at the time, George McDonald was the league president, and he wanted to fire me. And, you know, and Barney Deary, who was in charge of umpiring back then, the minor league, said, no, he's a good umpire. You're going to keep him. So I went my second year, and I calmed down a lot my second year. I only threw out 23 people. But then I think it's a combination of maturity and just starting to know the job and maybe getting better at it after 2 years at professional ball. And then I had like 7 or 8 in double A my third year, and I don't think I ever had more than that or down to 1 the rest of my career, the other 39 years. So I think it's just a matter of maturity and learning how to handle people's situations and becoming a little bit better at the job itself.
The problem is, though, that when you're in constant conflict, the players and the managers pick up on that, and now they're baiting you.
Well, I think that happened, but I was too naive or not smart enough to realize or know. It was just like survival every night at back then, you know, those first 2 years. Like I said, I didn't go to rookie ball. I skipped rookie ball, but A ball, I mean, back then, nobody knew what they were doing, really. You know, it was just a survival kind of thing every day. And just trying to be conscientious and get better at what you're doing. Because I knew, my God, if it's going to be like this, I better get better or get out. So,
What kind of winter jobs did you have? You just mentioned a couple. What did you do? Because, of course, you're making tremendous amounts of money as an umpire in the Florida State League.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, back up the truck every time there's payday.
Probably the hardest job I ever had in the winter was hanging drywall with my next-door neighbor. Had a construction deal. And I'd get up in the morning and be so tired. I'd get in the car, and we'd go down, you know, somewhere between Fairfield or walk down that area, and I just wake up. I didn't know what town I was in. I wake up, all right, John, time to go to work. I'd go home, I'd eat, and go to bed. I mean, it was one of the hardest things I ever did. But I bartended one winter. I substitute taught quite a bit. Two great jobs I had were with UPS driving just for Christmas rush. And that's about it. That was my years in the minors, because then I was fortunate that I became a quote-unquote prospect to the American League, and they sent me down winter ball in Puerto Rico. So I had a couple full winters of that. And then I taught at umpiring school for 10 years. So that was January into February every year. So my year was basically, while I was in the minor leagues, was pretty much consumed with baseball. A month and a half, maybe.
And you finally make it to the major leagues because you are a prospect and they're designating you to work in the American League, and you come to the American League May 6, 1983. Tell us the details of how you found out and the details of the first game.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if this is a leading question, but if it's not, you're really good, because true story. I got called by Dick Butler, who was the supervisor of American League umpires. Denise and I were married then, and she flew in on some off days. She was working for Eastern Airlines. And so I had a friend pick her up because I had to be, get ready for work. So I get this phone call, and he said, okay, tomorrow I want you to go to your first game to be in Detroit. And I was just ecstatic, you know. And then Denise shows up a while later. I tell her, so we go to work that night.
Where were you when you were told?
Rochester, New York.
Okay.
And then the next night was supposed to be like Baltimore playing Rochester. Now, back then, believe it or not, it was really like a nothing kind of game. What we would try to do, unless you had the plate, was pay a local guy to work the bases for you and have a night off. And I did that. I had third base, and I did that. So without cell phones back then, he tried to get a hold of me because there was a change. So the next morning, Denise and I drive from Rochester to Detroit, and I get there, and Durwood Merrill says, John, you got to come and call Dick Butler right away. And so I call him, and he says to me, John, where are you? And I said, I'm in Detroit. And he said, yeah, but what are you doing there? I said, well, you called me, and you said this was going to be my first big league game tonight. And he said, where were you supposed to be? And I said, and it hit me like, oh, my God, he means Rochester working at AAA game. So he was trying to get a hold of me, had no way to get a hold of me, and was angry, frustrated at me. But I was just so excited I wanted to get to Detroit. Well, it turns around, they switched me to go to Toronto. So we got in the car, drove to Toronto, and I got there. So not only was I at the wrong ballpark, but I was in the wrong country for my first baseball game.
And who would
but it worked out. And then I called him. I worked second that night, and it was Kansas City at Toronto. And I worked second base, and I called him the next day, Saturday morning, and I said, you know, explain how sorry I was. I was just so excited. I waited for this call for 7 years. And he was then he had somebody where they were supposed to be, and he was understanding, and it was water under the bridge. Thank God.
Thank God. John Hirschbeck is with us, the now retired John Hirschbeck, speaking to us while he's stretched out in his hammock. First ejection at the major league level was who?
It was Don Mattingly.
No, really?
Yeah. I forgot about that. Now they have these websites where you can look. I honestly, until a couple of years ago, didn't remember that. But I have a great 8x10 picture at home that was taken. Yogi Berra was the manager. Gene Michael was in the picture because he was a base coach or bench coach or whatever. Don Baylor was in the picture. And all four umpires and Don Mattingly and me. So it was a very, very full 8x10 picture.
One of the most mild-mannered guys, not a guy with a reputation for getting run.
No. Intense, but, you know, maybe my first year in the big leagues was like my first year in the minors. You know, I had to learn a few things.
And do you remember what the nature of the argument was?
Just over balls and strikes. Probably a strike that I called, I'm sure.
You made your debut May 6th, 1983. You were full-time in 1984. The story you're referring to was 1985. You had a game that Yogi managed the Yankees, and that was very briefly because Steinbrenner fired him after only 16 games that season.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And that's why Yogi stayed away from the Yankees then for so many years thereafter.
Exactly.
Tell us about your favorite catchers and pitchers. Working behind the catchers you love to work behind and pitchers you love to have throw to you.
Well, the catchers, Bob Boone, and I make myself sound old, which I am, but Bob Boone and Carlton Fisk. And you can say, well, geez, they're two pretty big guys, especially Fisk. But they were so great to work behind because they sat behind the plate and they didn't catch the ball. They received the ball, which is something I don't think players know about anymore. They catch the ball and they pull pitches and try and frame pitches, and there's a category for that now. But back then, they would receive the ball, and it was just, you knew getting behind them, you didn't care who was pitching, that, you know, you were going to see the ball well and get along with them. And I mean, they were hard-nosed guys, but very fair. They just loved working behind those two guys. Sal Butera is another name that in later years was kind of like a Bob Boone student, because I used to tease him when he first came up. I said, you know, you catch a lot like Bob Boone. He goes, that's who helped me, John. And another one, David Ross, who just retired with me last year. David Ross, a la Dancing with the Stars, right?
Right, David Ross.
I loved working. A couple of my World Series plate jobs, I worked behind David. Loved working behind him.
How about pitchers?
Well, of course, Greg Maddux. Was probably my ultimate all time. And David Cohn was great. I always liked guys. I didn't care how hard they threw or what they had. I loved pitchers that could throw strikes and knew where the ball was going. So those are a couple of my real favorites.
John Hirschbeck with us. The coldest you ever were and the hottest you ever were.
The hottest I ever. These are good. You had a couple of days to prepare. The hottest I ever was I think it was a Sunday afternoon game in Baltimore. I don't remember the year, but I know that was the hottest I ever was. And the coldest I ever was in Detroit in April several years ago. Not that many years ago, just a night game in Detroit. And the bases are the worst. You know, behind the plate, you have the chest protector on. And in all the years in the game, I maybe put gloves on my hands twice working the plate. Because you can really, the body heat gets going under the protector and the shin guards and everything. But on the bases, when you're just standing there, it can be miserable at times. There aren't enough hand warmers and body warmers to stick around under your neck and in your feet and on your hands. Especially when they're out there for 3.5 hours.
Exactly. A lot of people, I don't think, understand the physical toll that umpiring takes, all the injuries through the years. Give us a catalog of those.
of mine, oh gosh, minor knee surgery when I was younger, scoping. But let's see, neck surgery, back surgery, concussions. You know, they started keeping good track of that with the impact test around 2001. And I know from a period of 6 years, I had four major concussions, and that's only from like 06 to 11. You know, and who knows, God knows.
Who knows what happened before then, right?
Before that, exactly. But they're really, really good about it now. The MLB and Mark Letton, who's the medical person for the umpires, and he works with all the trainers. So the trainers for each big league team are aware of certain people that if they get hit, you're to take like extra care. They do with everyone anyway, but you're, you know, probably going to have to be taken out of the game. And they tell us if those guys say go, you go. You don't try and be a hero. You know, it could be the trainer for the Yankees, Steve, and he might say, John, you're done, and that's it.
And you're done.
Yeah, you got to do with this, so you're done.
You were behind the plate for Roy Halladay's no-hitter in the 2010 Division Series. You were behind the plate when Mariano Rivera set the all-time saves record. And you were behind the plate when Barry Bonds hit number 756. Rank those three occurrences.
The no-hitter, you mean in like what I thought was special?
Yeah, in terms of importance, Halladay, Mo Rivera, and Barry Bonds.
The no-hitter, for sure, because that I didn't realize it was a no-hitter until the fifth. You're in the playoffs, and you know you concentrate every night, every time you have the plate so much anyway. But it was in the fifth when I realized that he had a no-hitter, and I just wanted to make sure that my concentration stayed, you know, maximized, if anything happened in that game, I didn't want it to be because of me. So it was just a matter of just bearing down so hard, and because you felt it all along until it was over. So I would say that was number one. Mariano was two because, you know, you didn't know in the situation when you worked the whole game, you don't know if he's even going to be in the game, let alone have, you know, the chance for a save opportunity. So he comes in and it just happens and it's done. But, you know, he was really a good guy, good person. You know, it was fun to be involved with that. And then I would say third on that list would probably be the Bonds, although it was great to be there. Again, it was like, okay, is this going to happen tonight? You know, I still have to worry about doing my job. And so they're all three, you know, things that I say, boy, I'm really fortunate that I was, you know, luck of the draw, I was there for them. But that'd probably be the order I'd put it in.
Three of the great days in the history of Major League Baseball. Was the worst day with Robbie Alomar in September of 96?
Well, it was a terrible day. I look back with a smile on my face and say, why didn't I just say ball four, you know, and avoid it? And I'm sure he looks back and says, why did I just, you know, why did I do what I did? But, you know, I always say God works in strange ways. And, you know, and I honestly, I've said this for years, if that's the worst thing he ever does in his life, he'll have led a really, really good life. So, you know, things happen in our lives, sometimes for a reason, sometimes we don't know, but you try to make the best of things and move on. And I know that he has, and I know that I have, you know, and it's just something that happened. You say, dang, I wish that didn't happen, but it's in the rearview mirror, and, you know, you go on and just try and be a good person and live your life that way.
You and Denise lost your two sons, John Drew and Michael, to a rare brain disease known as adrenoleukodystrophy that runs in the family. You have devoted your life to this cause, and at the end of the day, Robbie Alomar has also been helpful in helping you raise money for these unspeakable tragedies that you and your wife have endured.
He has. When Michael died, this is our third year coming up. We have what's called the Magic of Michael, and it's a golf tournament with a dinner. This year we separated two. The golf tournament is going to be in July on the 17th, but the dinner is going to be in September on the 13th, and the reason for that is that this year's honorees our Tom Hamilton, first of all, with the Cleveland Indians, the radio voice, is going to MC it again. He did when we had Joe Torre 2 years ago. And Terry Francona, who was very close to Michael and our family and everything, and he's going to be our guest. And actually, Jim Tomei is going to come in and be there. So we're looking forward to it. But we've raised a lot of money, and we help children in Northeast Ohio with underprivileged children and children with disabilities, physical disabilities, and just to make their lives better, different projects that we've done. And we've also become last year associated with Akron Children's Hospital, which is really good because then you find out where a lot of needs are and people that don't have insurances and things that children need, wheelchairs, electric wheelchairs, whatever the situation might be. Just 2 days ago, back in Youngstown, a fellow that does work for us for these kind of things put a new door in for a family, and a little girl has multiple sclerosis, and she's crawling around and just, you know, and can't get around the house, and new floors in for them. And another young boy that we just spent some money for has multiple sclerosis and cerebral palsy, I'm sorry. And he's getting a guide dog that we're helping to finance. So just all kind of things like that. Ramps for children that need wheelchairs and whatever we can do to help.
It's wonderful when you consider what your family has gone through and your daughters. Michael suffered from seizures that left him unable to drive a car, live on his own or work and have a steady job. And he was beloved, especially his relationship with Terry Francona, working as his bat boy in Cleveland. There are no words to express a loss like this.
No, there's not. And there's so many people. Ron Gartenhire was another one. Ron actually took 2 days off when he was managing the Twins to come to Michael's funeral. And, you know, Michael Batboy for the Yankees, Joe Girardi. So there were so many people that were good to Michael. He was a fixture in baseball. I mean, I don't know how many people realize it, but he Batboyed in more cities than I would be on the field working. And, you know, he'd be over in the dugout and just knew to keep his mouth shut and do his job, and he did it well. They liked him, so he was he loved his love in life was baseball, and it just happened that his father was a major league umpire, so he got to do a lot of things in his short 27-year life.
Indeed, and you yourself, all that you have been through, beside the injuries that you just cataloged. You missed the 2008 season following back surgery. You've had two occurrences of testicular cancer when you were told there was just a 10% chance of it recurring, and it did return, and you missed the 2012 season. You have endured so much physically.
Yes, but you know what? I had a great employer, and again, it's a blessing that Major League Baseball throughout in 90, when I found out about the boys and John, we had to move to Minnesota and go through John's bone marrow transplant, Michael's bone marrow transplant, and John was literally dying each day before eyes. And, you know, baseball, just Dr. Bobby Brown then said, John, go and do what you have to do for your family. When you're ready, you know, your job will be here. And when I had cancer, you know, Rob Manfred, everyone took care of me that year. And then even when Michael died, you know, and I was home and I fell and shattered my kneecap, and baseball is, you know, I can't say enough about through all this. We're blessed to have good insurance, and I was blessed with a great employer. So it made our lives a lot more tolerable to feel loved by the people that you work for.
Well, you deserve that, and you earned that. John Hirschbeck, in our remaining moments, I didn't even mention that you developed a tumor on your kidneys, and you nearly died of renal failure, and it took 32 sessions of chemotherapy before you were cancer-free.
Yeah, it was, you said earlier, 10%. They had actually told me less than 5% that it would come back after removing my right testicle, and it did, and at the time I needed back surgery, so kind of disguised it, but the tumor was pushing on my kidneys, and they weren't draining. And yeah, they said if I hadn't gotten to the hospital one more day, I would have died from renal failure. So I was lucky that time, wasn't I?
yes, you were.
Yeah.
What will you miss in your new life?
What will I miss?
Yeah.
Just the people. But Yeah, just the people. I can tell you, I don't miss actually umpiring. I don't miss the travel, and I don't miss the hotels. I'll miss the people, but I'll say this, the people, there's a lot of people that I'll still see. You know, guys come through Tampa when I'm down here. They come through Pittsburgh and Cleveland and spring training. The guys in this area, you know, we saw for dinner and everything. They came over our house, and I'll still get to see. You know, there's some people and coaches in Pittsburgh and Frank Coonley and, you know, some people in Pittsburgh, some people in Cleveland that I'll go out of my way because they're just good people and friends and, you know, just to say hello.
When you walked off the field for the last time after the World Series and took off the equipment, did you have any special thoughts?
The World Series was hectic. The only thing I did, I have to tell you a funny story. Everybody knew that, you know, after that was over, I was retiring. So at 10:12, I stopped the game for that rain delay, and I went down to our locker room behind home plate in Cleveland to tell Joe Torre, you know, exactly what was going on. And he looks at his watch, and he said, "Well, John, you thought you were going to retire today, but it's not going to happen." So it went past midnight to
yep.
November 3rd before I actually got to retire. But the only thing I did that I just wanted to do as I was walking off the field, I like kissed my fingers and reached down and touched home plate just as I walked off for the last time.
Very nice.
Yep.
What are your plans? What do you want to do?
I'm having fun down here fishing and playing golf. And, you know, I love to hunt and go back to Ohio and just do a lot of fishing and a lot of golfing. And we'll see. You know, I just want to relax for this first year and see what the future holds. But I'm very busy. I'm not a sit-around kind of guy. And if the people could ever see what my wife and I are doing right now out here in the driveway, they'd realize it. But no, we're always busy, always doing things, and I can always look back at the winners because basically I was retired the winter. You know, you come home from playoffs and World Series and things, and you're off until spring training, and I was always doing something. I don't ever sit around and, you know, watch TV. So I think we'll be busy. I actually know I will be. A lot of interest, a lot of fun hobbies.
What a life for the high school kid who began umpiring Little League games as a part-time job.
Very blessed. Yes, sir.
John, great thanks. So that'll do it for John Hirschbeck and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.